welcome to another episode of Radio Wild. We hope you had a wonderful weekend and a wonderful Thanksgiving. Today is Monday, December 7th, and we have a great show lined up for you today. I'm Alan Lacey, your co-host for this episode of Radio Wild. My other co-host, Chris Anderson, is unable to be here today. He is on a business trip, but wishes his warmest regards to you all. We have moved into the holiday season, which means family, friends, and great food. It also means it's a perfect time to get a last-minute holiday gift for someone through our online store at wolfcenter.org. The Wolf Education and Research Center runs solely on the support of people like you, and this year has been a challenging one. Why not make Christmas special for the wolves this year and support our cause? You can also donate directly on our website to take advantage of the great tax incentives thanks to our nonprofit status. The Owyhee Pack would really appreciate it if you did. Anyways, getting back on track, today we will be talking with Brooks Fay, president of Predator Defense, as part of our continuing discussion on the Great Predator Debate Series. We have been recreating interviews that will be featured in our upcoming film titled The Great Predator Debate, A Nation's Dilemma, which is soon to be released. Each episode over the past several months has featured a unique perspective from one of our dynamic characters in the film, representing multiple sides of the issues and many of the stakeholders involved in this debate. We have been exploring the issue of whether or not man and predator can coexist with one another. Today is no different. But before we get into the good stuff, let's take a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. Today's program is brought to you by the Wolf Education and Research Center, along with the Wild Artists Guild. Located in Winchester, Idaho, the Wolf Education and Research Center provides the highest quality captive animal care and education possible, and it's inspiring greater public tolerance toward apex predators. They engage in the public to support sustainable relationships with nature to become a social norm. They envision a growing community that works toward a more sustainable relationship with nature. This is achieved through captive animal care, regional interpretive programs, and ongoing development of contemporary media through the Wild Artists Guild. Partnering with diverse cultures and traditions, they strive to build a united and stronger future for all species. In just a few moments, we are going to hear from Brooks about his organization. We just finished a two-part interview with Oregon trapper Stan Thomas. It was insightful to hear his thoughts on wildlife management and to hear about his years of experience working with wildlife services. To offer the other side of the debate, we will be talking with Brooks about his work with Predator Defense. It's a privilege to have you on the show, Brooks. First of all, can you give us a little background on your organization?
Predator Defense started off as a wildlife hospital in 1990, and for the first 5 years of our existence, we specialized in caring for predator species such as cougars, bears, coyotes, bobcats, animals that had been hit by cars, cotton traps, poison, orphan. In 1995, we transitioned into what is now called Predator Defense. And we are basically a wildlife activist organization and more of a political watchdog organization for predator species, wolves, cougars, bears. And what we do, most of what we do is advocate for animals that are being killed, such as wolves, cougars, coyotes, and we're monitor lethal, government-sponsored lethal predator control programs.
There seems to be quite a bit about lethal predator control programs in the news lately. Is this because they are becoming a nuisance, or what do you think the issue is?
Well, I mean, predators historically have been much maligned, and they have been heavily managed over the last century, meaning killed. And oftentimes it's because of ranching and hunting and these types of interests where the hunting community sees predators such as wolves and cougars as competition for the same game that they're hunting. And of course, ranchers are concerned about wolves, cougars, coyotes attacking their livestock.
We've seen in the past several decades the rapid growth in our cities, which has resulted in displacing a lot of habitat for wildlife. Do you think animals are trying to, quote, reclaim their old territories in cities, which is causing some of this conflict?
Well, actually, I don't think it's that the animals are coming into town more often as much as people are going out into, you know, expanding more and more into wildlife habitat. Of course, you've got to remember that the wild animals were here first. In regards to animals like coyotes, for quite a long time now, they've had an ability to basically adapt and become urbanized and survive in urban environments. And the reason they're doing that is because as human beings, we've through our garbage and feeding pets outside and other attractants, we've basically attracted them into these areas for an easy lunch. In regards to animals such as, say, cougars or black bears, oftentimes we inadvertently attract those animals by, say, feeding deer in our backyards with alfalfa, putting salt blocks out, things like that. And with bears, not properly disposing of garbage and having open compost pits, things like that.
Yeah, there's recently been an issue with a bear in town just outside of Portland that wildlife officials had to trap and euthanize. It's unfortunate, really. The bear was only falling into the tempting trap that was left out for it by mankind. However, we do hear about incidents outside of town. It seems as though these encounters in the wilderness are also on the rise. Is there a reason for this, you think?
Well, the human beings, what scientists call visitor days, visitor hours to, say, cougar habitat. Each year, through backpacking, mountain biking, outdoor recreation, more and more people are venturing into, say, cougar territory. And so that's why you hear about, say, more people supposedly seeing cougars. And it's, you know, I think it's important to remember that this is nothing extraordinary, really. These are native species. They do exist. And occasionally we have the privilege of actually seeing them. There's nothing really to be fearful of.
There still seems to be quite a heavy management of these species, though, in order to prevent any potential threatening encounter from occurring. Do you think this is the type of management of apex predators that is necessary for our safety?
Well, in my opinion, I really think what's extraordinary about North America and pretty much all the apex predators that we have here is that, for the most part, they really don't want anything to do with people. And where I really see management meaning to be done is managing people.
You bring up a great point, Brooks. Currently, the MO is that we need to manage these apex predators in order to protect people from danger. However, we've seen that the actual threat from these animals is actually much lower than we are led to believe. Do you feel that in some cases, though, management of these species is necessary?
I feel the current concept, I feel management means one thing, killing. And most of the time, I believe it's unnecessary. I think it's often a political reaction to appease a certain constituent, such as the ranching community. And then oftentimes, it's also, as in regards to management, the killing of, say, wolves and cougars to appease hunters who, again, are concerned that wolves or cougars are taking some prey away from them. And what's actually been shown through science is that just the opposite's happening, that cougars and wolves actually make the prey populations healthier, genetically stronger, by weeding out the sick animals, essentially.
Do you think that these predators have a direct relationship to the health of their environment?
Oh, there absolutely is, and we've learned that, and what we've seen over the last 20 years since wolves were reintroduced into the Northern Rockies are things coming back into much more of a natural equilibrium.
Yeah, exactly. And what does that equilibrium look like?
Basically, with wolves, cougars, coyotes, just much more of a balance in between all species, where we're seeing benefits through, say, riparian areas and areas that historically were heavily browsed by deer and elk. Now some of these plant communities and some of these, say, willow, aspens, trees, cottonwoods, trees like that, are now having the ability to come back. And then what we're seeing is more songbirds returning, and so more biodiversity, essentially. And we see that across the spectrum with animals like wolves, cougars, and coyotes.
And why is harmony important to nature?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the world right now, I think we're, as human beings, we're incredibly out of sync with nature. And whenever that happens, I think there's a backlash. I think there's serious ecological problems. So I think it's very important for us to live in concert with nature, not try to fight nature, not try to manage nature. every time we try to manage nature, it usually backfires.
Are there any examples that you can think of that illustrate this?
Absolutely, and the eradication of wolves, grizzly bears is a perfect example. You have ecosystems that are really a ghost of what they used to be. And now where we have areas where wolves have returned, wolves coming back into Oregon, we're seeing again in these areas where they're occurring, much more biodiversity.
Do you think that the myths and common misperception of wolves and other predators is feeding this anti-sentiment towards these creatures? Is it possible that our wildlife managers are susceptible to these same myths?
Unfortunately, it's evolving, but all too often I believe that it's a negative image and that it's basically derived from movies, Hollywood, and fairy tales like Little Red Riding Hood and things like that. So I think the public perception of predators like wolves and cougars is growing. And unfortunately, wildlife management agencies often add to the misconception by putting out information that really is more politically driven than based on any type of sound ecological principles.
In some ways, you could suggest that there are now new myths that have added on to the old ones, don't you think?
Well, we, as humans, again, I think we fall into a big mistake. The myth that we've been fed by wildlife management agencies, which are funded through hunting revenue, is that we need to control wildlife populations or they'll just reproduce and there'll just be too many animals. And what science has showed us in published peer-reviewed research is just the opposite, that predators like wolves and cougars and bears actually control their own population by a bunch of different evolutionary processes.
Wouldn't this be a conflict of interest, though? I mean, they are tasked with managing our wildlife, yet make money by hunting them?
There's absolutely a conflict of interest, and I hear this actually from agency folks, obviously off the records. As long as they're receiving their funding through extractive interest, the information that these agencies turn over to the public and to the media is going to be skewed. And again, we look to universities and scientists for actual, you know, hardcore ecological perspectives, science. And unfortunately, we don't get that. Oregon's really a perfect example. We're now killing more cougars in Oregon than were killed during the bounty era. And yet, published peer-reviewed research shows the aggressive hunting of cougars actually leaves a population of very young animals, juveniles and subadults. And these are typically the animals that tend to be seen more often, prey on livestock, where it's the older, say, male, big male toms that hold territories are actually animals that control the young dispersers, as they're called, and often lethally control them. They'll kill them. So again, these are part of an evolutionary process that's been going on for thousands of years. And where we run into problems is when we think that we can manage these animals themselves. Humans, when we go out to hunt, to say kill deer or elk, I'm going to back up again. Yeah. Humans, because my nose, when human beings go out to hunt, say deer or elk, they often target the best of the gene pool, the largest elk, the largest deer, the one with the biggest rack. It's very macho. Well, with predators like cougars or wolves, they actually have an ability to find the weakest animals, the genetically inferior animals. And by doing that, they, by preying on those species, they make that species stronger, the prey species.
It's the natural selection process, keeping the equilibrium.
Absolutely. Predators across the spectrum, whether it's coyotes, bobcats, wolves, grizzly bears, are playing an important role by, again, keeping a natural equilibrium, not just with other animals, but what's remarkable really is how they affect the plant community around them. And that's what we've seen in Yellowstone and, say, in other areas of the Northern Rockies, areas, again, that were heavily browsed by deer and elk, riparian areas, stream areas, that really never had a chance to develop and grow back into forest. Since the reintroduction of these animals, we've seen a lot of these communities, plant communities, come back, and then also different songbird species returns that were much lower in numbers than they were.
Why then is there so much fear towards these animals if they are as good for our environment as they say?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. The cougars, that there have been many cougar attacks on people. In actuality, in the last 125 years, there have been 24 fatal cougar attacks on human beings in all of North America. So that's a perfect example. With wolves, I believe there have been maybe 3 or 4 attacks ever in all of North America, fatal attacks. So when you compare that to, say, people being attacked by dogs or people being, you know, harmed by other things, people running into deer on the road, scientists can't even model the possibility of saying a cougar or a wolf attacking somebody because it's so spectacularly rare, these events. You can't even develop a computer model to basically predict such a rare event. What's really remarkable, I find, in North America with wolves and cougars is that really they just want to be left alone. They don't really have any interest in really wanting to be around people. Occasionally we'll attract bears by our bad behavior, by just, again, leaving food out and those types of things, inadvertently feeding animals. But for the most part, bears, cougars, wolves want to stay as far away from people as possible. And historically, they want to prey on their native prey, deer, elk, animals like that.
That's interesting that you bring that up. It makes sense that these predators would want to stick to their prey base. Although when I was down in New Mexico filming, we did witness the results of a livestock depredation by wolves on a 2-year-old calf. It makes an easy target for and an easy meal. Why then aren't there more depredations than there currently are?
Say a cougar is looking at a deer or an elk, and that light bulb over its head goes off and it's just shining. It's looking at that animal and it's interested. But say that same cougar looks at a cow or a sheep. Well, that light bulb over its head is just kind of flickering because it's really not registering. And of course, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of years of evolution of these animals hunting their natural prey. And animals like cows and sheep have more recently been introduced to the landscape over the last 150 years, say. And so it's remarkable when you look at these species, given the opportunity, and when we don't fool with them. They want to hunt their native prey, and this is the same with coyotes. 95% of coyotes' diets is rodent-based.
It just doesn't add up to me. If coyotes, for instance, eat 95% rodents, then why are they viewed with such disdain? They are hunted year-round and without permits in a lot of places. Doesn't this have a negative effect on the ecosystem?
Well, I think some of the issues, say with coyotes, we know now that when you kill coyotes, especially indiscriminate campaigns such as the U.S. government through its the USDA Wildlife Services Program indiscriminately kills, last year, 2014, close to 70,000 coyotes. And that, of course, doesn't include the offspring that starved to death because there was no mother or father to feed them anymore. So potentially hundreds of thousands of animals, just coyotes alone. And what we have since found over the last several decades is that when you kill coyotes, they have a remarkable ability to compensate. It's called compensatory mortality, to where when you go in and indiscriminately kill coyotes and you kill one of the alpha pair or the alpha male and alpha female, you have animals within that pack that are what's called behaviorally sterile, that will not breed females and males, that the alpha male and alpha female will not let them breed. And so you go in and destroy that pack social structure, and all of a sudden you have subordinates, maybe several in the pack, that now can breed. And so that's a classic example right now, and we know this through science. Yet we still continue to kill coyotes. Science tells us basically we shouldn't. And it's extremely counterintuitive. You would think if you kill a lot of animals, you're going to knock down their population. But in reality, they come back twice as strong. And so sometimes it takes us a long time to learn lessons.
Wouldn't this upset the equilibrium of the ecosystem then? I mean, with so many coyotes, wolves, cougars, etc. being hunted and lethally removed from the landscape, wouldn't that be an issue? Why then aren't there quotas for hunting specific predators and game species?
Wildlife populations are like a wave. They're not static. And oftentimes, wildlife management agencies try to set these static goals, especially for deer and elk. But wildlife populations, again, are like a wave. They go up and down. And the two things that really affect them are weather and the condition of the habitat, the condition of the forage, the sedges, the forbs, the grasses, these things. And so it's, again, we get into problems as human beings when we try to manage species. I think we should spend much more time managing ourselves and protecting what we have left of the natural world. It's all disappearing very, very quickly.
It's quite obvious to notice the changes that are happening. Do you think people care enough to make a difference about it, though?
Yeah, I think some people just don't care. And for whatever reason, and I don't think there's much hope of changing those people. I think some of the indifference is driven through monetary issues. We have some relics that still exist. The USDA Wildlife Services Program is really a program that shouldn't exist anymore. If they were to continue, it would be appropriate for them to work with the ranching community to show them how to prevent livestock losses, not by killing predators, but by teaching them just basic husbandry. I think there's another important component, though, that we have to think about, that I do believe that there are areas, especially in the West, that are simply inappropriate for livestock production, and that instead of going in and killing predators, we should just basically shut down those areas. Most of these areas are public lands that the American taxpayer is subsidizing for, you know, basically someone to carry on a tradition to the detriment of the land, to the detriment of the ecosystem and riparian areas. And so I think that's something to talk about too, and all too often it's not. We have Forest Service land and BLM land that's incredibly fragile, and that is really a mirror of itself to what it looked like 150 years ago in regards to biodiversity. And it's just, they've become these moonscapes almost. And that what's remarkable, if you look at Yellowstone or even here in Oregon, the Heart Mountain National Antelope Refuge, when cattle were removed in the early 1990s, you go to the refuge today and you'd hardly recognize it from 20 years ago. It's astounding of how it's come back, and that there's more pronghorn antelope on the refuge now than have ever been recorded in history. And they flourish along with coyotes. And so again, there are examples out there. We just need to take the time to look at them.
Why then is there such a polarization on both sides of these issues?
Well, I think it's much more the other side. I think our side has really been the side of science and reason and compassion, and again, trying to live in harmony with nature and trying to correct some of the wrongs. And I think the opposite side, say through the livestock, cattle, sheep production industry, is for well over a century, they've had their way. And that many, you know, the wolves were essentially eliminated because of livestock production. And so it's the status quo, and they don't want things to change. It's just like the USDA Wildlife Services Program. Once you start an agency whose mission it was to kill a bunch of predators, they don't want to go out of business. And so they're going to fight. And then with the hunting groups, I think it's driven, I think many of these groups we actually have done pretty well.
Yeah, we have. Okay, go ahead.
I think there's also an economic interest expand for many of the hunting groups is the sky is falling. If wolves come back, or if we don't control cougars, there's not going to be any deer or elk to kill. And what the states, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, have shown us, there's plenty of deer and elk and with predators, with healthy population of predators. And I think, I mean, I've seen with some hunting organizations, their memberships, you know, just expand dramatically. And so I think there's a business end of this. And it gets into organizations that promote trophy hunting, which we're absolutely against. We have hunters, Predator Defense has members that are hunters, but they're hunters who hunt for deer and elk to put in their freezer, not to put up on their wall. And then we're absolutely against the killing of predators, except in individual circumstances, but those are very rare, rare circumstances. But for trophies, no.
A lot of it seems to be polarization on both sides, though. I mean, it takes two to make an argument, so to speak. Do you feel that the wildlife advocate side has become polarized?
Oh, I don't believe we're polarized at all. I believe the other side has been polarized, anti-science, anti-humane, reactionary, and politically divisive. I think the environmental wildlife advocacy community has been remarkably tame for a long time and still is. You know, it's oftentimes the vitriol, the hatred that comes out of some of these hunting groups and the ranching community is off the charts. As a director of an organization, I've lost track of how many times my life has been threatened, dead animals that I've had thrown in my driveway, hate phone calls, hate mail, and yet I've never threatened or been hateful or harmed anybody from the other side. And our membership too tends to be people that are more humane and compassionate towards not just animals, but people too.
Do you think that people are catching on to this and realizing it's a futile attempt to keep hanging on to the old-fashioned ways of managing wildlife? Or even better yet, do you think that ranchers are catching on to the concept that predators are here to stay, so they might as well learn to live with them?
I think they are. I think it's happening slowly and gradually. But then I also believe that there are people that we have some ranching families that are members of the organization that have been around for half a century that have never had problems with predators. They've simply always used common sense husbandry practices, lamb operations, sheep operations. During the lambing season, they shed them at night. And they're out there with their flocks. They're keeping an eye on them. When you look at some of the operations on open, you know, what I think is unreasonable at this point in history is the whole idea that we can have open range public lands ranching where you have cattle and sheep on huge tracts of open range with basically no supervision whatsoever. And that I would like to see public lands ranching come to an end. I don't think the American taxpayer should be subsidizing it. But since it is still in existence, my feeling is while ranchers are still able to do this, if you have losses because you've chosen not to have a range rider out there or guard dogs or what have you, you absorb those losses as part of doing business. You can't constantly be at war with the natural world.
So, talking about ranchers real quick. As we are running out of time, how do ranchers do predator-friendly operations? What are some of the things that they are doing that are non-lethal?
Well, one of the big things is just having, not an open range, but on you know, typical pasture ranching, having electric fence lines, guard dogs. And the most important thing is human presence. There are far too many ranching operations where people get, I call them almost boutique ranches, where they'll get some animals, and basically that's it. They pay very little attention to them. So if you're ranching sheep or cattle, you've got to invest time into doing it. And that will also oftentimes mean investing in a guard dog or several guard dogs or a guard llama. And during birthing seasons, just using common sense, bringing those animals into sheds at night, or corral confinement where you have these portable fencing systems, electric Jenny fencing systems where you bring your flocks in tight at night and have somebody there in a little camp trailer or a guard dog, this type of thing. And, you know, when you have a federal agency such as Wildlife Services that will come in and by mandate, they have to respond, even if you've used no husbandry whatsoever. You can have a goat chained to a tire in the middle of nowhere, and if a cougar or a coyote preys on that, you can call Wildlife Services and they'll come in and they'll kill that coyote, or they'll kill a bunch of coyotes or a bunch of cougars. So we can't do that any longer. We shouldn't be doing that any longer.
Well, thank you, Brooks. We are down to our final question for the day here. I wanted to leave you with this last question on the day. How do you feel about the future of wildlife, particularly the future of wolves and other predators in our country?
I think I don't want to say I'm pessimistic, and I don't want to say I'm optimistic. I think we're at a very interesting point in time, and I think what happens over the next several years will really determine that. And I think it'll be a shame if we brought back wolves again to repeat the mistakes from the past. And that's certainly what's happened in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. And I think Oregon has an opportunity to really set itself apart. And I don't ever want to see wolves hunted or trapped for sport in this state. But I also feel the same way about cougars. I don't think we should be hunting cougars. I don't think we should be hunting coyotes or bobcats. These animals are critically important for the ecosystems, and I think they have just as much right to be here as we do.
Thank you, Brooks, for joining our show today and talking with us about your work with Predator Defense on behalf of wild animals across the country. Well, folks, that just about wraps up our show for today. Remember, you can tune in on the first Monday of each month for another exciting episode of Radio Wild. You can check us out online at www.wolfcenter.org or follow us over on Facebook at facebook.com/wolfcenter. Be sure to keep an eye out for our next episode. You don't want to miss it. Happy holidays from everyone here at Wolf Camp. And on behalf of myself, Alan Lacey, and my co-host Chris Anderson, we wish you the best. Till next time.